She says, I want to write something so simply about love or about pain that even as you are reading, you feel it. And as you read, you keep feeling it. And though it be my story, it will be common. Though it be singular, it will be known to you, so that by the end you will think, no, you will realize that it was all the while yourself arranging the words, that it was all the time words that you yourself, out of your heart, had been saying. I think that's really quite a beautiful place to start about what we're going to talk about. Since we've basically been, I've been setting the kind of field for you to give you an idea of how accessible Buddha's mindfulness was. What Buddha did was he saw something that we all have the capacity to see, but it comes from being willing to adjust where we put our attention, where we put our awareness. Just think about this for a minute. The Buddha's mother died when he was about, I think, 7 days old. So I think she only lived 7 days into it. So he was raised by his aunt. His father, this king, is a little obsessive about the Buddha becoming his successor, right? So you got to be a king. I'm a great king. You're going to be a great king. You know how parents can get when we already got it planned out for our kids. So we kind of obsess over what they do and how they do it. So he's got a father that's kind of doting and very obsessive about what you're going to be. His mom died. His aunt was loving and kind, he said later in some suttas, about describing how kind she was to him. But it's not mama. So there's always that little bit of missing something. And then when he finally, so he's in an arranged marriage, but it said that he really did love this woman by the time he left. And they, right after his child is born, he realizes, this is the moment. I gotta go. He's getting disillusioned. So when you start actually stepping out on the path where you're gonna actually move into enlightenment, as strange as it might seem, not move into enlightenment, I don't want to say it like that, but what gets us onto the path towards searching for enlightenment is actually disenchantment. You are no longer enchanted by the state of your existence. Things that used to make you happy don't make you happy anymore. Things that used to give you a spark of, you know, stick-to-itiveness don't work anymore. That sounds a lot like depression, doesn't it? You're like, oh man, this is jacked up, I hate it. That is what starts you off in the path of towards awakening. So he is disenchanted with life. He just had a baby. He really loves this woman, but he is about to bolt out the door and leave it all. He lived with whatever he wanted, so all of his pleasures in life were taken care of. He leaves all that. And then I read in one account, he actually took all of his clothes that were people would begin to see that he was a princely being. He took all that and gave it to his driver and left with pretty much nothing, so that nobody would even know and recognize him as a princely being. That's what he stepped out in. So all the stuff you guys got, your cars, your house, everything that you have that helps you feel like you have succeeded in life, you'd have to walk out the door away from that, be disillusioned with it. Then when he's sitting there, I just want to paint this a little bit more graphically so you can begin to get what he had to see in order to be amazed. So he's sitting. So first he's tried all these great practices. He went to these great teachers, and they say that he could get to these states of bliss that were abound, like fantastic. He could just get there. We struggle to try to get there, but he could just get there. But then, you know, you get hungry. You got to come out. Go eat. It's basic. It didn't satisfy him. It didn't seem to work. It seemed like I still keep coming back to the suffering. I get to these blissful states, and then I keep coming back to the difficulty. That's not working. I got to find out what's going on here. So then he tried another practice, these aesthetic practices. That's a Jains. It's the opposite. You don't do anything pleasurable to the body, and you basically just steady yourself. You actually are trying to, I don't know exactly their practice, but I'm assuming you're trying to no longer feel unpleasant with the unpleasant. So you're trying to move your mind away from feeling unpleasant as a bad thing. So to do that, you got to go into a lot of unpleasant. Unpleasant, 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 all the time.
Did you say Jains?
Jains. J-A-N-E-S. That's the name of the spiritual group he was practicing with. I think it's J-A-I-S. J-A-I-N-S. That's what it is. J-A-I-N-S. Anyway, so he's with this group, and there's five of them, six of them altogether, including the Buddha, and they would sit in various places. And I mean, it got really bad. He's said to have eaten only a grain of rice a day, so you're starving all the time. Your body is withering away. I'm sure there's a hell of a lot of pain because you sit a lot. It ain't working. He can't seem to get past this anger. Can't seem to get past this unpleasantness. And it's said that there's a moment when he remembers being peaceful. So he's dying. He's out here by himself, and he has this memory of a moment when he felt peaceful. Life was going on. Things were coming and going at this like a festival, and he was just a little kid, and he felt peaceful. And then he had a moment that I'm going to point to. In that moment of noticing, I felt peaceful here, he decided, I need to get my strength back. And I need to figure out why I felt peaceful. Right? What was that? Why did I feel peaceful then? That sense of wanting to know, that interest in, turned the corner for him. Because some woman came by, felt sorry for him, and offered him something to eat, and he ate. And he started getting his strength back. And, of course, all of his homies, his crew, they were like, the Buddha, he's, you know, his name was Siddhartha. Oh, Siddhartha, he ain't got it. He's already messed up. You know, he's taking the easy way out. He didn't make it. So they leave him. So now he's all by himself. He's basically thinking he failed because he wants to investigate something, but he's got to eat, and he's got to get his strength back. So he's kind of like messed up on that whole practice thing. Now he's on his own. And he goes and he sits down, when he gets his strength back, he goes and sits down in the tree, under the Bodhi tree, and there's a sutta where he explained how he divided up his thinking. He noticed that he thought a lot about anger, so he's probably thinking regret and, you know, mad about this and mad about his friends leaving him, regretting whether he should have left. He don't have any money, he doesn't have a lot of food, he doesn't have a lot of stuff, and he has some regrets, and there's all this anger and irritation and disappointment, and I miss mama, and you got all these thoughts going on. And he realized that there were a whole group of thoughts that were dwelled around harm, aversion, and what he didn't get. And then he had these other thoughts that were based in non-harming and kindness and in his constant reminding himself of renunciation, to let go of everything being the way he wanted it. And when he divided these thoughts up, he realized these thoughts go to suffering, these thoughts don't. So he began to dwell on these thoughts. And then he thought, even further into the sutta, if I dwell too much on these thoughts, then I get into suffering also. So I gotta just touch into these thoughts, stay over here, but not too dwelly. And then he began to move into a different space and time, understanding, and he began to see things like impermanence and the natural state of suffering. But he saw all of this. The things I want you to begin to think about is, he saw all of this by himself, right? There's nobody there with him. He had to have some capacity to turn towards practice, because no one else is sitting there with him. He had to be willing to trust in the practice against the backdrop where there's a lot of things not right. A lot of loneliness, a lot of regret, a lot of sense of failure. Doesn't this sound familiar? Like, this is the place we're at. This is where practice is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be when we've got everything all beautiful and smooth, like the blissful states that he was in. That didn't work. It's not just obsessing over the negativity in our world. That doesn't work. It's when we get to a place where we're willing to turn into the practice and investigate this nature of what we call peace and contentment. What is that? Where is that? How do I get there? How come I was there before and it's not there now? You're having this, what he called a result of seeing dukkha. He said the result of seeing our dukkha, dukkha being suffering, that's the English translation of it. The result of seeing our dukkha is that we either go back into the bewilderment or we take on a noble search. I think that's why when you start meditating more and more and more, you see more and more and more difficulty. Because you're basically saying, show me all the mess that's going on here that's keeping me from contentment. So this. And we think that this stuff that we see is a problem, so we turn back into delusion, bewilderment. But what Buddha saw was, oh, why is this so difficult and this is so good? Let me see. Let me check a little bit further. That's what I want to encourage you to do, is check a little bit further. So I'm saying all that to say that I think that moment what we're seeing is the continuation of suffering. You could consider it like the continuity of suffering. That's what we're seeing. We're seeing how continuous our suffering is. And there's a reason why we see it like that. It comes because we have a mind, a thinking mind, that's basically setting us up for failure. It's setting us up to make life seemingly better than it actually is. And it's done in what is called commonly as the four distortions. So there are four distortions. One, we have a mind that convinces us that things are permanent that really are not permanent. An example would be, we sit in a meditation and it's beautiful. You sense that stillness, the mind is kind of calm, everything just seems so upright, alert, you feel it, you love it. Bing, bell rings. It's sort of like, oh, but that's okay, because the next time you sit, you're going to get that back, right? Wrong. Next time you sit down, mind is going to be all over the place, and you're going to be struggling with the, why can't I get that back? Right? Trying to get it back, because the mind has convinced us that that place is the place we're supposed to be. So that's where I have to go every single time. Instead of just letting sit be sit, whatever it looks like, we keep trying to get back to that sit we had. That's this sense of permanency. Or we finally get some job we like. We think it's going to be great. I can't wait. And then, 6 months into it, they come and tell you, I'm sorry, we have to let you go. It's not really working out for us. And then we're all disappointed, like, what has happened? I thought I had it. I thought I made it. We buy our car. It's great. It's beautiful. And then somebody hits it. There's all this thing that the mind has us believing life is permanent and still and stable. And if I get that permanent, still and stable, then I'm going to arrive. And then it's going to be okay. But the truth is, life is never still, it's never stable, it's always shifting and moving and changing. And every good thing that you buy is about to, at some point, it's going to get ugly and raggedy, and dents are going to show up on the car, and all of a sudden you're going to look at that car and be like, ugh, I don't really want that car anymore, I need a new car. Everything that we think is going to be great is going to eventually lose its luster. So this thinking something is permanent when it's not permanent. Thinking some state, feeling good, I get up in the morning, I feel great, thinking it's going to be permanent, and it's not. By the time you get to rush hour, I don't know if you guys have rush hour like we have rush hour. This is Victoria, so maybe rush hour is not the best example. You got to come to Seattle, try to drive around during rush hour, and you'll know. Or the other one is that we keep expecting things to be satisfactory, to feel, to give us this reliable sense of happiness. So we have these ideas, the mind is convinced that if I have certain things, we've seen pictures, we've seen movies, if I look a certain way, if I have this stuff, that's it, that's what I got to do, just get all that, and then everything's going to be okay. So that sense of expecting satisfaction to come out of the things in our lives and the stuff around us and the stuff we get, or, somehow if I feel pleasant, that means that everything is going to be okay. But in the real sense, all of these things give us a temporary satisfaction because it eases the grasping. But it doesn't, it's not lasting. It doesn't last, and before long we'll be grasping again. Or we assume life, like we have this identification with life, assuming it's about us. And really, it's a hard thing to realize that it doesn't have anything to do with us. People don't even see us. They see their own stuff, and they're responding to their own stuff. We don't even see other people. We're responding to our stuff, and we're like bumping into each other, not because we are trying to hurt each other as much as it is that we don't see other people, and we're just trying to get ours. We're just trying to make sure everything's okay for me and my family. I'm just trying to make sure that, you know, everything around me is good. And we don't necessarily see the cost that it is to other people. I don't know if the last time I was here I told you guys this, but when I was a trial lawyer, we had administrative staff. And so I was practicing, and I was really beginning to see a lot of harm that I was causing in other people's lives. I didn't really pay attention to it that much. But when it really hit me was I used to have court documents typed up by the administrative staff. And I gave this one of the administrators one of the documents. And when I came back from lunch, she had it in this basket by my door. So I picked it up. And I went into my office reading it, and I noticed something that was wrong, and I came right back out. And when I came right back out, I saw her go, like, I said, wait, what? What was that? She said, what? I said, what was that? That look you just did. She goes, what? Nothing. Nothing's wrong. Can I help you? Do you need something? And I said, I saw that. That kind of roll in your eyes, like, what is that? Do I do something wrong? She said, Mary, you're the worst. You're never satisfied, never, never. It doesn't matter how many, I can do one document 15 times and you're still not going to be satisfied. I never knew that. I always thought, oh, wait, there's a mistake here. You got to fix this. Oh, I didn't see this one before, but you got to fix this too. Oh, you got to fix this. That's all I saw was, I'm just trying to get the document fixed. I'm not thinking I'm saying you did something wrong or you're bad or you got to, you know, you're not good enough. And she helped me see that my dissatisfaction is added work for her. I never saw it that way. So we came up with a plan. We came up with a template. She would make them all just like that. If I needed to change anything, I got to do that myself. But that wouldn't have happened if I didn't see that, that rolling of the eyes, like, there she goes again. I knew she wasn't. I think she was looking at me saying, how long is this woman going to be in that office before she comes back and brings it to me? But that moment in time, and because I was tweaking my capacity to see, I could see something that I had not seen before. I could see the harm I was causing. So on one hand, seeing the harm feels painful. But on the other hand, it's only when you see the harm can you actually adjust so that it's non-harming. So we have to see some of this difficulty. So this taking things personal, it's not personal. It's just the nature of the way we are, and we want to see. It's not personal. The last thing is, if we see things, we expect it to be lovely, attractive. Basically, it's not attractive. We expect the world to be lovely, pleasing, beautiful. Everything's supposed to be nice and kind and everything's good. But really, we live in a world that's very aggressive, rough, difficult. Things are crashing together. If we look at nature in and of itself, it's not all that lovely. It's quite aggressive. But yet, for some reason, as human beings, we think it should not be aggressive. It should be lovely and nice and sweet and kind, and everybody's happy, and we're just moving along. But in order for one group of people to be happy and moving along, there's a whole bunch of other people not so happy, not moving along. But we don't see that. So this idea that the world should be lovely, that is a distortion that the mind creates for us to see. We got to see these distortions. They come out of the mind. They're hardwired into our brains. It's not. It doesn't have anything to do with you or me. It's the nature of the minds we happen to be existing with. It's automatic. It's elusive. So it's like a film over the top of the, like the film you have to scrub off of cucumbers. You can't really see it. But if you scrub a little, you think you got it, and then you got to spray that stuff on it and scrub a little bit more. It's kind of thick on there. You don't necessarily notice it, but it's there. Ajahn Sumedho, who's this Thai forest monastic, he said, you could use suffering as a clue to enlightenment. A clue or a key to enlightenment. That's what Buddha did. When you're in this suffering, you are actually trapped. You're in a distortion. I'm going to give you something to ponder over lunch. When you are suffering, there is a distortion there. If there was no distortion, you wouldn't be suffering. Now I know all the minds in this room is going to think about all the bad things that have ever happened to you. Say, that's why I'm suffering. That bad thing happened to me. That's not why you're suffering. That is what Buddha saw. He saw that it wasn't because his mom died. It wasn't because his father was doting on him. It wasn't because he had given up everything and he had left his family. He saw a path out of that suffering when he saw that it had nothing to do with the outer conditions, but it had to do with something that was happening in his mind, these distortions. And when he saw the distortions, it opened up this capacity for him to liberate that mind, the flow of it. A way to think about it is, I bought these new glasses. These glasses are very difficult because they're so light, I don't know that I have them on sometimes. I can't tell. I think I'm seeing everything the way I really see. But if I take them off, or they slide down, or something happens, then I can tell, oh, yeah, I see things very differently when I don't have the glasses on. See, it's pretty clear when I do have the glasses on. It's sort of like that. We forget we're looking at life through glasses. We can't change that distortion. That distortion is the nature of our minds. But when you know you're looking through a distortion, then you can access a level of escape from its deluded nature. You can see that you are behind the clouds, not the sun is behind the clouds. So we're trying to learn, how do I see the distortion so I cannot be caught in it? That's what the wisdom is that we're looking for. And in order to do that, we have to begin to see the distortions itself. So this afternoon, we're going to talk about seeing the distortions, beginning to see how it is, learn how I can see the distortions. But before I go too much deeper into it, I want to see if there's any questions about what you've heard so far, and then we'll talk about how to eat lunch. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the distortion of not taking things personally? I know that's not what it's called.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the thinking things are personal that are not personal. So on one level, we think, so everything that we see in life, we identify with it as somehow saying something about me. And a perfect example could be, you and I could have a great moment in time. So we're like this, we had this retreat, we had this great moment, everything is great. It's like, oh my God, seems like you and me are hitting it up. And then we go about our business, and maybe you see me downtown, and you're like, Tori! And I just walk right by you. And you're like, oh, she just dissed me. You probably were like, I know she did not just diss me, but the idea that you think I saw you and I ignored you, you think that is the reality. But you may not be able to tell that I didn't even see you, or that I had other stuff on my mind, and I may have been looking right at you, but I'm not really seeing you. Do you see what I'm saying? But from your perspective, we take it as personal, like you saw me and you completely blew me off. It's that kind of beginning to see how much I is in everything, how much everything in my life is based on what I think it has to do with me, when in reality, much of life has nothing to do with me. So even though I was telling one of the groups my mother died, and even though as soon as she died, it was unexpected, I felt like somehow I got hit in the gut. Like somehow, why would, I can remember seeing older black women and thinking, why are you here? Nobody likes you. My mother, everybody liked. Why is she not here? I mean, there's a sense that somehow life did something to me, and it's unfair. When in reality, it was just my turn, you know? Many mothers have died before me, and many mothers are going after mine. But it was my turn to experience the death of a mother. That kind of understanding takes it out of the personal. But we tend to think everything is personal. So we have to learn how to see, how am I taking this so personal? Once, it doesn't necessarily mean the death of my mother isn't going to be painful, but I can hold it if I know this is something we all kind of go through. If we all sat in this room and said, oh yeah, my mom died, I know what that feels like, it helps me be able to feel it also. But if I think it's closed into just my difficulty, then it gets much more unbearable. So that's what the taking the personal is like. Yeah?
Could you say something about the end of relationship?
So like a loss?
Like divorce.
Like a divorce? So that's another one of those, all of this stuff we're talking about really, taking it personal, thinking something's going to satisfy you, thinking something's permanent, it's all out of an attachment that our minds normally get to. Soon as something happens to us, we like it, we attach to it. We don't like it, we try to get rid of it, right? It seems... It's like imagining that something is attached to you that you don't like. You try to get rid of it. Or something you do want, you try to get attached to it. It's this nature of attachment that's happening. The difficulty with attachment is that we cannot stop our minds from attaching. But once you have that attachment there, you are necessarily stuck with the pain of what happens with attachment. And gain and loss is one of the parts of attachment. Pleasure and pain is one of the parts of attachment. Praise and blame is one of the parts of attachment. And fame and ill repute is one of the parts of attachment. So when you have something like the loss of a relationship, it is unavoidable. Once you get into a relationship, you can't avoid the pain of losing. If you die before your partner, you're going to feel the pain of your death. If they die before you do, you're going to feel the pain of that death. If you break up, if something changes in the relationship, you're going to feel that loss. But that changing nature of the relationship was inevitable the minute you got into it. When we don't expect that change to come, then we feel a lot of the pain. My teacher one time, Rodney Smith, said, I think this is a great example, a great equation, that the degree of suffering that we are going to go through with loss of any kind is the amount of time that we don't accept what is upon us. So it's not to say that I have to just buck up and accept my mother died, because I couldn't. It took a while to get to a place where I could accept that she died. But as long as I had that sense of you should not be gone in the midst of the reality that she is gone, I'm going to suffer. But as soon as I finally came to grips and accepted she died, all mothers die, it's a part of life. I don't like it, but this is the way it is. Then the suffering of her death got less and less and less and less. Do you see? So really, it's at beginning to see that loss is inherent in life. Changing relationships is inherent in life. It's inevitable. It's not, it doesn't say anything about you, it doesn't say anything about your partner, it doesn't say anything about your relationship, your life. It's just life. And we have to learn to come to terms with that truth of it when it comes upon us. Sometimes it takes longer than we want for us to come to terms with it. But inevitably, if our practice is around, how do I come to terms with this difficulty that's come to me, then you can handle it. Yeah?
You use poetry a lot.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Mm-hmm. Now.
Could you tell us a little bit about, I noticed you have Wendell Berry and Margaret Atwood and those people tied into nature, Wendell Berry's take on our current time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this suffering that we're experiencing with our impact on the earth is reflected in poetry.
Yeah, it is.
And so the suffering that you're talking about is something that we're experiencing as a population of people.
It is. It's the thing that I think the Buddha was pointing to is the more we're able to see the natural rising and falling of difficulty, the natural aspect of life that makes being human difficult, the more we're able to see that as a natural law, it's the nature of things, the less we fight that, the less we fight it, right? And the more we stop fighting it, the more capacity we have to stand up to it. It's really this is probably the best way I can explain it because I'm older. All the young people in the room probably are going to be like, what? I don't get this. All the older people are going to understand. I did not grow up with computers. I didn't grow up with digital world. I didn't grow up with things like cell phones and things like that. So I remember when I very first, when the whole world was moving from the flip phone to the smartphone, and I refused to get one of those things. It just seemed too complicated, and it was just a phone. All we had was you pick it up, dial it, and that's it. And here, this smartphone, it wasn't even as smart as it is now, but it was so complicated to me. And my nephews and nieces could use them with ease, but I was so resistant, I would not get rid of this flip phone that I had, mostly because I thought it was too complicated. I thought I wouldn't understand it. And no matter what people were saying, I just don't understand. I can't get it. The mind, it's too much for the mind to wrap around that. And my kind of resistance to getting one of those phones made the whole conversation about those phones complicated. I would get irritated if my nephew would say, "Auntie, you should get a, you should get this iPhone or this." I'm like, "No!" I just get irritated. Then I got one. It wasn't that complicated. I kind of just had to work with something new and practice using it. And now I'm obsessed with it. I can do all the little gadget things. But do you see what I'm saying? It comes from this capacity to be accepting of the moment in time. But much of our energy is the resistance to the moment in time rather than being in the moment in time. And what I think Buddha taught, what I think he taught after, which is why we're going to talk about mindfulness tomorrow, is what he taught was mindfulness is how you are able to be in the moment, even with things that are very, very difficult. So if we jump to mindfulness today, most of us will skip over how to apply mindfulness to a difficult situation. Instead, today, we got to dwell on the difficulty so we can get used to it, so that when you start talking about mindfulness, you're not trying to use mindfulness as a way to keep from feeling difficulty. You're actually using mindfulness as a way to help you stay with the difficulty so you can see past it. So in a way, if you're going to try to see if mindfulness can help me, you know, get these people to start paying attention to what they're doing to the planet, it's not going to work, because there's a whole bunch of people, I don't know why, but there's a whole bunch of people that don't believe in climate change. I don't really quite get that, but maybe they need more time before they can see what's happening. And in some respects, if you're closed into your world and all you think about is your own little family, you might not see that the world is changing and our climate is falling apart. You may not see that because the only thing you pay attention to is getting up, going to work, going to church, getting up, going to work, going to synagogue, getting up, going to work, going to temple. That's all you do. Birthdays, anniversaries, you just pay attention to that movement of the world. You're not paying attention necessarily to the weather changes. I could talk all day long to those people and they wouldn't understand a word I'm saying because they're not seeing that. And I can get irritated, like whether or not I want to use a smartphone. But if I pay attention to the changing of the this delicate system, ecological system we're living in, then I'm going to have some mindfulness to help me stay steady in the midst of that. And that means I have to see the truth of the difficulty, including the difficulty of people who don't even care what they're doing to the environment. I got to hold all that at the same time. And to do that, I'm going to have to strengthen my mindfulness. That's what it is.
Can I ask you one quick other one? You mentioned that mindfulness is sort of a secular
thing. There is an aspect of mindfulness that's secular.
Uh-huh. And yet you're interpreting it through the teachings of the Buddhist ideas.
Right, because Buddha coined this phrase mindfulness. And yes.
Way back
2600 years ago. They were talking about
Did he use those words?
The translation, the English translation of what Buddha called sati is the mindfulness. We translate that word to mindfulness. But Buddha's discussion of mindfulness came in relation to opening the mind and liberating the mind. It was not in relation to relaxation. That's the difference. So we're what I want to talk about mindfulness is how can mindfulness help you free your mind, not how can mindfulness help you get more relaxed. Because the more you use Buddha's version of mindfulness, less relaxed you get. You kind of know what I'm saying, don't you? So it's that. If you're using the secular idea of mindfulness, then you're trying to get relaxed. And that's not what we're trying to do here. We're trying to see, how can I be with something uncomfortable and free the mind's grasping around it, attachment to it being a certain way, loosen that so I can experience some level of contentment. Okay, that's probably a good place to stop. Get something to eat. So, we'll come back at 1:30. And what I'd like you to do is to try one more sense door, two more sense doors, seeing and tasting. Probably the smelling one too. So seeing, tasting, smelling. Whatever you do, I'm not going to say don't talk. I don't necessarily believe you need to be in silence the whole time. I think the hall here should be in silence. But if you go outside or you go somewhere to eat and you want to talk, then that's fine. But seeing, you want to see the varying colors and shapes and textures of what you're eating. You want to smell it and you want to taste it. So if you get so caught in your talking that you don't do that seeing, tasting, smelling, then take a back, take a step back, like coming back from your thinking, so that you can come back and reconnect with what you're actually eating there. Keep one thing in mind, if you talk too much, this next sit, you're gonna have to come all the way back down to where you were before. So the less you get too expressive, the easier it's gonna be. But it's part of life. This is what you're trying out and seeing how far can you go, and how hard is it to come back to stillness.